From New York, this is Democracy Now!
The president has been consistent in his view that there's not a military solution to Afghanistan, that we have been there for far too long. That has been his view for some time.
President Biden's vowing to end the longest war in U.S. history, withdrawing all troops from Afghanistan by September 11th. We'll get response from an Afghan professor and a former State Department official who resigned his post 12 years ago to protest President Obama's policy in Afghanistan.
The United States has been culpable in the violence that has beset and just besieged the Afghan people for more than four decades now.
Then, American Insurrection, a new Frontline documentary, looks at the rise of right-wing extremism across the country.
I think about a revolution against the government. We're past the point of peace.
From Charlottesville to the assault on the Capitol.
One of the darkest days in the history of our nation.
We're seeing this country fall apart before our eyes.
We'll speak to journalist A.C. Thompson and filmmaker Rick Rowley. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Biden administration's unveiled plans to withdraw U.S. troops from Afghanistan by September 11th, the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. The move would end the longest war in U.S. history. Over the past two decades, the war has killed more than 100,000 Afghan civilians, 2,300 U.S. service members, and has cost the U.S. trillions of dollars. NATO forces are also expected to withdraw 7,000 troops by September 11th. This is White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki.
The president has been consistent in his view that there's not a military solution to Afghanistan, that we have been there for far too long.
The White House announcement comes just over a week before the scheduled start of a new round of peace talks in Istanbul between the Taliban and the U.S.-backed Afghan government. But on Tuesday, the Taliban announced it would boycott the talks because President Biden is reneging on a deal made by Trump to have all U.S. troops out by May 1st. We'll have more on Afghanistan after headlines. In Minnesota, protesters took to the streets for a third straight night in Brooklyn Center, where a white police officer killed 20-year-old Dante Wright, a black man, during a traffic stop Sunday. Police fired projectiles into a demonstration in front of the Brooklyn Center police station, declaring it unlawful and ordered reporters to leave. Kim Potter, the officer who killed Dante Wright, and the city's police chief, Tim Gannon, both resigned Tuesday amidst mounting anger. Potter was also an officer trainer. Dante's aunt, Naisha Wright, responded to the news of her resignation during a joint news conference with the family of George Floyd.
She was the law. She was the law, right? Protect and serve.
Okay.
Put her in jail.
Yes.
Like they would do any one of us.
Yes.
Naisha Wright also revealed George Floyd's girlfriend was her nephew's former teacher. Philonis Floyd, the brother of George Floyd, also spoke at the news conference.
Minneapolis, you all can't sweep this under the rug anymore. We're here, and we will fight for justice for this family, just like we're fighting for our brother.
Yeah.
To the protesters all around this nation, stand up.
Stand up.
We need you all to come out.
The emotional press conference was held outside the Hennepin County Courthouse, where the trial of former police officer Derek Chauvin continued inside for a 12th day. Chauvin's defense called its first witnesses, including Barry Broad, a former police officer and so-called use of force expert, who argued Chauvin was acting, quote, with objective reasonableness when he kneeled on George Floyd's neck for over 9 minutes, leading to his death. New body cam footage was also shown to the jury of Floyd sitting handcuffed and giving his name and birth date to Minneapolis police officer Peter Chang, among the first officers to arrive at the scene before Chauvin. Talks are set to resume in Vienna today between the U.S., Iran, and other parties to the landmark 2015 nuclear deal just days after an attack on the Tehran's nuclear facility in Iran. Iran is blaming the attack on Israel, which is staunchly opposed to relaunching the international accord. Iran said Tuesday it will ramp up its uranium enrichment efforts following the attack. The Biden administration is moving ahead with more than $23 billion in weapons sales to the United Arab Emirates after reviewing a deal made under President Trump. The deal includes the sale of Lockheed Martin F-35 jets and armed drones. Anti-war groups and progressive lawmakers have called for the U.S. to stop all arms sales to the UAE over its involvement in the Saudi-led U.S.-backed war in Yemen. Ukraine says 40,000 Russian troops have amassed on its eastern border, prompting some to warn Russia could be preparing for war. Another 40,000 troops are in annexed Crimea. But others say Russia is sending its soldiers to the region as a show of force and intimidation to Ukraine and its allies. The U.S. and NATO have vowed to support Ukraine, though it's not a member of the alliance. Analysts also say Russia could be seeking a distraction from domestic issues, including the imprisonment of Alexei Navalny. Meanwhile, Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin said Tuesday the U.S. military will increase its presence in Germany, a reversal from the Trump administration's plans to withdraw troops. Austin said the move reaffirms U.S. support to NATO and, quote, improves our ability to surge forces at a moment's notice to defend our allies, he said. President Biden sent an unofficial delegation of former government officials and former lawmakers to Taiwan 2 days after Taipei said China sent 25 warplanes into its air defense zone. China has been increasing military drills around Taiwan and warned the U.S. against intervening in the territory over which it claims sovereignty. In Burkina Faso, authorities have charged exiled former President Blaise Compaoré with the murder of Thomas Sankara, who was killed in a 1987 coup. Sankara was a revered leader and anti-colonialist Marxist who enacted popular social programs and was dubbed the African Che Guevara. Compaoré succeeded Sankara, his one-time close friend, and was eventually ousted decades later in a popular uprising in 2014. He will be tried in absentia. The Guardian reports Facebook knew right-wing Honduran President Juan Orlando Hernandez was using thousands of fake Facebook accounts to make his political campaign appear more popular and let him get away with it for nearly 1 year after the company was alerted to the activity. Facebook reportedly learned what was happening in 2018 with posts on Hernandez's page receiving engagement from tens of thousands of fake accounts. But Facebook took no action until the following year, even though it violated Facebook policy. Hernandez, a key U.S. ally, has long been accused of spreading misinformation online to discredit his critics and undermine social movements. In coronavirus news, the European rollout of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine has been delayed after regulators here in the United States moved to temporarily halt its use as reports of extremely rare blood clots were being investigated. South Africa also suspended its use of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. Six women, aged 18 to 48, reported the clots after receiving the shot, and one has died. The number represents less than 1 in a million administered J&J shots in the United States, and it's not yet known if the condition is linked to the vaccine. What is known is the standard treatment of blood clots, heparin, is contraindicated for this reaction. President Biden sought to reassure the public the pause in J&J's use would not hamper the White House's vaccination goals.
So there's enough vaccine that is basically 100% unquestionable for every single solitary American.
India is fast-tracking the approval of foreign-made vaccines as it reported yet another record daily caseload of 184,000 infections Wednesday. Mumbai and the state of Maharashtra is going into a full 2-week lockdown.
This disease is spreading at a horrifying pace. I say horrifying because today's numbers of positive cases in the state is the highest so far. Nearly 60,212 COVID-19 positive cases have been reported in the state today. Hence, the situation is very grim.
In other coronavirus news, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres is calling on governments to impose a wealth tax on rich people who've profited from the pandemic. A recent report found the world's wealthiest have seen their fortunes surge by $5 trillion since the start of the pandemic. Back in the United States, a new report by the Capitol Police's watchdog reveals officials knew Congress was the target of the deadly January 6th insurrection, yet officers were instructed to refrain from deploying a more aggressive response. Officials on duty January 6th said the use of crowd control equipment such as stun grenades could have helped, quote, push back the rioters. We'll have more on this story later in the broadcast. An ally of embattled Florida Congressmember Matt Gaetz is reportedly cooperating with the Justice Department in its probe into Gaetz's possible sex trafficking crimes. Joel Greenberg, a former Florida County tax collector who's himself been indicted for sex trafficking, told investigators he and Gaetz gave cash or gifts to women in exchange for sex, this according to a New York Times report. The House Ethics Committee recently launched its own investigation into Congressman Gaetz, a well-known Trump ally. President Biden is nominating Robert Santos to head the U.S. Census Bureau. Santos is president of the American Statistical Association. Santos, who is a Mexican-American, would become the agency's first permanent director of color. If confirmed, Santos would fill the term of Trump appointee Steve Dillingham, who quit in January following whistleblower complaints over the agency's attempt to rush an inaccurate report on undocumented residents. In reproductive rights news, the Food and Drug Administration will allow providers to mail abortion pills to people who choose to terminate an early-stage pregnancy without surgery for the duration of the pandemic. The move was welcomed by medical groups that had been fighting a January ruling by the Supreme Court, which sided with the Trump administration in enforcing the in-person requirement, even after a federal judge waived it in order to spare patients unnecessary travel during the pandemic. Wisconsin is on track for a devastating wildfire season, as hundreds of blazes have already caused destruction comparable to the whole of 2020 in just 4 months. Tony Evers, the Wisconsin governor, declared a state of emergency last week. Climate groups say wildfires are likely to get worse in Wisconsin due to increasing droughts and heat waves. And New York announced it'll become the first U.S. state to divest its pension fund from tar sands companies. Divest New York Coalition said, quote, it's wrong to be invested in companies that are destroying the planet, and it's also financially unwise, considering that the world is transitioning to renewables, which is causing fossil fuel values to steadily decline. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the Quarantine Report. When we come back, President Biden is vowing to end the longest war in U.S. history by withdrawing all troops from Afghanistan by September 11th. Stay with us.
Though the road is rough and the rock, and tomorrow
The Rocky Road by the Paragons. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York City, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, the Biden administration has unveiled plans to withdraw U.S. troops from Afghanistan by September 11th, the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. Biden will formally outline his plan today during a speech in the Treaty Room at the White House, the same room where President George W. Bush announced the start of the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan nearly 20 years ago, beginning what's become the longest war in U.S. history. The war killed more than 100,000 Afghan civilians and over 2,300 U.S. service members. It also cost the U.S. trillions of dollars. NATO forces are also expected to withdraw its 7,000 troops by September 11th. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki discussed Biden's plans Tuesday.
The president has been consistent in his view that there's not a military solution to Afghanistan, that we have been there for far too long. That has been his view for some time, well documented, well reported on. He believes that and he remains committed to supporting negotiations between the parties, which many of you may be following, are resuming next week. And he also believes we need to focus our resources on fighting the threats we face today. 20 years, almost 20 years after the war began.
Biden's announcement is coming just over a week before the scheduled start of a new round of peace talks in Istanbul between the Taliban and the U.S.-backed Afghan government. But on Tuesday, the Taliban announced it will boycott the talks because Biden's reneging on a deal made by President Trump to have all 3,500 U.S. troops out by May 1st. In recent weeks, the Taliban attacked a secret U.S. military base in eastern Afghanistan, as well as Kandahar Airfield, which houses hundreds of U.S. troops. On Tuesday, a senior Biden administration official told reporters the president's committed to the withdrawal regardless of the situation on the ground in Afghanistan. The official said, quote, "This is not conditions-based. The president's judged that a conditions-based approach, which has been the approach of the past two decades, is a recipe for staying in Afghanistan forever." We're joined now by two guests. Zahir Wahab is an Afghan-American professor who taught for decades at Lewis and Clark Graduate School of Education in Portland, Oregon. He was born in Afghanistan and has regularly returned since the U.S. war began in an effort to rebuild Afghanistan's educational system. He was a senior advisor to the Minister of Higher Education in Afghanistan from 2002 to 2007. He also taught at the American University of Afghanistan for 7 years. And we're joined by Matthew Ho. He's a senior fellow with the Center for International Policy. In 2009, he resigned from the State Department in protest against the Obama administration's escalation of the war in Afghanistan. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Professor Wahab, let's begin with you. What is your response? President Trump said the troops would be out by May 1st. President Biden has extended that to September 11th. It would end the longest war in U.S. history, the number of casualties in Afghanistan well over 100,000.
Good morning, Amy and Juan, and good morning, Ho. Ho and I were on a program at the University of Oregon in Eugene some years ago. Thank you very much for having me, and it's great being with you. I approve of President Biden's decision to withdraw all of its forces, but I want to point out that the United States and its allies should never have attacked and occupied Afghanistan. It was wrong, it was illegal, and I think it was immoral. But now, the United States and NATO withdrawing, the war will end in some ways. But we have to point out that there's a domestic dimension to the war, and the war amongst the Afghans will definitely continue.
Can you talk about the effect of this war for the last 20 years, and then what it means that at this Istanbul summit, one side, the Taliban, has pulled out because they are protesting the fact that Biden's continuing beyond the May 1st deadline President Trump promised?
Right. As you pointed out, you know, for the last 20 years, I've spent more than half of my time in Afghanistan. I have almost gone there every year and spent the last 7 years there full time. We must know that this invasion and occupation and the bloodshed have destroyed the country, its economy, its institutions, its infrastructure, its education, its way of life, relationships among the different ethnic groups. This occupation has been nothing short of a catastrophe. And this is why I say, you know, there are three dimensions to the war. There's the domestic dimension, the regional dimension, and the global dimension. And we also should point out that many, many reports by credible institutions, you know, and individuals like Cigar, Washington Post, and also the Afghanistan Analyst Network have repeatedly demonstrated and documented that the ruling elite in Washington have been lying about the war, and so have the Afghan clique, whoever was in power. So the war was wrong to begin with, and of course, an enormous amount of money and blood has been invested, and here we are 20 years later admitting to the world that this was a mistake and it was a failure and it's time to leave. But leaving now would be highly irresponsible because, as I said, domestically, Afghanistan is a very divided country. There are several major ethnic groups that are in conflict. We know that, for example, the price of guns is going up, and that the very people who are actually, some of them, who were warlords and have an enormous amount of blood on their hand, while they're going to be participating in this conference, if this happens, their people are also constituting militias and buying weapons. So while the United States may leave, the war may end for the United States, but the war will intensify for Afghanistan, unless something must be done, and that is that we need to constitute a UN peacekeeping force immediately. And while the United States is withdrawing, the UN security force or peacekeeping force should move in and be in place. We also need to establish a trust fund so that no dollars would go into Afghanistan except going to that trust fund and spent with the advice and guidance of an international cadre of development.
President Biden says that they're going to withdraw troops, no conditions, no preconditions, by September 11th. Can you talk about what are the forces that are there? And do you believe that all those forces will leave? Talking about NATO, he's talking about U.S. troops. But what about mercenaries, private contractors?
Yes. As we know, there are 3,500 known American troops, and there are some 6,000 contractors, many of them from third countries. And there are also some 10,000 NATO forces. Although some of the NATO countries have said that they will extend their stay in Afghanistan, most of them are likely to follow the U.S. example. As I said, the United States should withdraw because as long as the U.S. is in Afghanistan, the Taliban war against the Americans and all foreigners will continue. But the dilemma is that when there are no forces, outside forces, there will be a war, a civil war, or multiple ethnic wars or proxy wars in Afghanistan. And we must make sure that, as I said, is the UN peacekeeping force to maintain peace and law and order so that people can have normal lives. Right now, the country is in every way unlivable. You know, tens and tens of people get assassinated every day, other than the war between the Taliban and the government forces. But also, if there are no foreign forces, no matter what the shape of the government might be, the Taliban are likely to prevail and take over in just about 2 months. That's why we need some guarantee, international guarantee, with the presence of peacekeepers to make sure that there's peace, stability, and tranquility in the country, and so that the country can be built. But we must also make sure that no money is given to any Afghan government. But also the problem is that while these delegations, for example, talk about going to Istanbul, there are right now disagreements amongst the members, the 19 members of the government delegation or the Afghan delegation, as to the nature of this agreement, its agenda, and the items, and what it portends for the country.
Well, I'd like to bring in Matthew Ho to the discussion, a senior fellow with the Center for International Policy. In 2009, he resigned from the State Department in protest against the Obama administration's escalation of the war in Afghanistan. Matthew Ho, welcome to Democracy Now! Could you talk about your reaction to the recent announcements in terms of the Biden administration policy for the future?
Good morning, Juan and Amy. Thank you for having me on. And Professor Zahab, it's good to be with you. I've learned a lot from you, sir. This is potentially very good news for the Afghan people. The Afghan war has been going on for more than 40 years. This war begins in the late 70s, and it's been going nonstop since then. So it's really, it's not correct for us to say it's been 20 years, because it's been more than 40 years. There hasn't been a formal peace process in Afghanistan in over 30 years. So for this peace process to continue to go forward, foreign forces must be removed. Now, you know, Juan, Amy, I've been talking to you all for more than 11 years, and I was just thinking about how 10 years ago I was on with you the morning after the Osama bin Laden raid. And both of President Biden's predecessors have said they would remove all the troops. It's, you know, and so the idea that we may still be here talking about this is what really weighs on me right now. Also, regardless of whatever the intentions of the Biden administration are, the onus is now on the Taliban. Whatever they do can now give context or reason for the U.S. and NATO to say, look, we're not going to withdraw anymore, or even possibly resume offensive operations, or maybe even send more troops. What this does to me, and this may sound skeptical, but I think if you, again, understanding these post-Cold War wars, as well as all American wars going back to the Native American genocide, this gives the U.S. and NATO a decent interval. This puts, again, the weight of responsibility on the Taliban for the next 4 or so months. And this allows the administration a reason to abrogate the withdrawal, to abrogate the peace process. And I say this again because of the evidence of the post-Cold War wars in the Muslim world, as well as, you know, just the general history of American military warfare. The other thing I think it's very important to remember is that this does not include the thousands of men and women who are part of U.S. Special Operation and NATO Special Operation teams, CIA teams, as well as the, you know, literally dozens of squadrons of attack aircraft and bombers, whether they be manned or droned, that are in the area, stationed either in land bases or on aircraft carriers outside of Afghanistan. So the potential for the United States to remain involved militarily is quite high, even if all 3,500 acknowledged U.S. troops are withdrawn, as well as the NATO troops. But again, this is potentially good news because this is the step that is necessary for the peace process to go forward, and that's what the Afghan people desperately need.
And Matthew Hoke, could you talk about the toll on the Afghan people? You yourself served in the military in Afghanistan years back. The 2.5 million Afghans are now officially registered as refugees with the United Nations. The impact of this more than 20 years of the U.S. Period. But then there was also the period before that when the Soviets were occupying the country.
And this, you know, Juan, this precedes the Soviet occupation. This really begins in 1973, the same year I was born. So 48 years ago, the king is deposed. And at that point, if you're an Afghan, there's been hardly a single day without some type of violence or political chaos. By the time the Soviet Union invades in 1979, 100,000 Afghans have already been killed in the fighting. And it's important to remember, because we want to remember what the role of the United States has been in Afghanistan, that the United States starts funding the Mujahideen, the Islamic militants in Afghanistan, at least 6 months before the Soviet Union invades. This was a plan by Jimmy Carter's national security advisor, Zbigniew Brzezinski, to bait the Soviet Union into a trap in Afghanistan, to give them their own Vietnam. And so the effect on the Afghans has just been catastrophic. It has been well over 40 years of fighting. Millions of Afghans have been killed or wounded. The devastation on the Afghan people is hard to imagine. That 2.5 million refugees are what's registered right now. But there have been millions and millions of refugees for the last 40 years. For most of these last 40 years, the Afghans have been the largest refugee population in the world, with the exception of a period of time when the Syrians were. But as the Syrians go back, as that war has wound down, the Afghans, I believe, are once again the largest refugee population in the world. It's something like 70% of Afghans subsist on a dollar a day. There is no industry in Afghanistan to speak of. There is no infrastructure. The only industry you can speak about is the narcotics industry, which is heavily dominated by the Afghan government and the Afghan military. The Taliban have a role in it, but for the most part, the chief players in the Afghan drug trade are the Afghan government, our partners. The Afghan government itself is corrupt and predatory. The Taliban are hideous and horrendous, but the Afghan government is not much farther behind them in terms of human rights violations. And as well, too, this notion that somehow we have built democracy. You hear a lot about we can't leave Afghanistan because of the gains we made, the progress we made. And that's all it's propaganda. The Afghan elections have been incredibly fraudulent since the United States invaded. They've only become more fraudulent with each one. So what this effect on the Afghan people has been incredibly disastrous, and the suffering that they have endured and continue to endure is I think it's something that we here in the United States cannot possibly imagine.
Wahab. Yes, Professor Wahab, I'd like to ask you as well the impact of this war on the Afghan people as well from your perspective. And the prospects, what you see for the prospects once the United States pulls out, for Afghanistan to finally have an era of peace and somewhat stability.
Yes, well, I totally agree with Matthew, and that is a country has been destroyed. Ashraf Ghani himself said, you know, that 70% of the population lives on a dollar a day, and that half of the government revenues are stolen. So the government is highly corrupt, inefficient. You know, it's sort of a rentier state, inefficient, ineffective, has no credibility, no legitimacy. The people live in constant fear. There are about 1.5 million internally displaced people, other than the 3 million or so diaspora, Afghan diaspora. So, and there's no infrastructure. The education system is horrible. Healthcare. People still don't have electricity in the capital, regular electricity, drinking water, food, you name it. There's no work, there's no employment. And anyone who can is in some way leaving the country. So we have wrecked the country, you know, while occupying it and bombing it. We have not really attempted to build this institution and its infrastructure. So while leaving the forces, you know, may solve one of the U.S.'s problem, but as I said, there are internal dynamics in Afghanistan, and that there's going to be a resurgence of a civil war, proxy wars, and multiple wars, because Afghanistan, as I said, it's a highly polarized and divided country. The ethnics dislike each other, do not trust each other. Right now, amongst the team members of the Afghan delegation, there are conflicts open. People are arguing, you know, as to who is who and how many of which group, et cetera, et cetera. So, and unless we have solved the problems, you know, the war will resume in a more vicious way. That's why I say we must replace the U.S. NATO forces with some kind of a U.N. peacekeeping force. And also we must continue, the world community must continue to subsidize Afghanistan development, but must be done very, very differently. Right now, what we have done is we have empowered and resourced the very wrong people, the kind of people who should be on trial, you know, and the people who should probably be in jail. So I worry a great deal. Why I agree, and I welcome the U.S. withdrawal, but as I said, you know, they're leaving Afghanistan without any kind of a solution, without any certainty that that the country will not go into a violent situation. So I really argue for a U.N. peacekeeping force. Why don't they? You know, because we have U.N. peacekeeping forces in several other countries, and it looks like it's working. Why not Afghanistan? It will be much cheaper, efficient, effective, and sure that the country can stand on its own feet.
And finally, we have just 30 seconds, Professor, but Khalilzad, who has served under Trump, has served under Bush from Iraq to Afghanistan. He's Afghan-American, serving now under Biden. Do you hold out any faith in him?
No. Ashraf Ghani, I'm sorry to say, he's a PhD, John Hopkins, World Bank, etc. But the man has no basis, no credibility, no legitimacy in his policies, his daily behavior, his, you know, disregard for the conditions, the terrible conditions of the people. These have made him, he cannot take a car. You know, he always has to fly places, just like the American ambassador in the capital itself. As I said, when there's no protection from abroad, he will be gone in 2 or 3 months, you can be sure.
Zahir Wahab, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Afghan-American professor, I'm sure we'll be getting back to you as this all develops. And Matthew Ho, senior fellow with the Center for International Policy, who resigned under President Obama from the State Department because of his policy in Afghanistan. Next up, American insurrection. Stay with us.
Another day, are they emptying the rubbish? Have the kids gone out to play? Are you waiting while the bar fills up? Watching while they read the papers? Read the headlines over breakfast? Red lines, deadlines, has the milk come? Is it time to have a crisis? Is it safe to go out shopping? Crisis, crisis, panic buying, water dripping on the carpet. Normal, normal, just another. Want to read the papers? Have the shops run out of rubbish? Is it time to have a crisis? Still the means? Take your clothes off. Can you stand it if I touch you? Watching
Crisis by Poison Girls. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. A new report by the Capitol Police's watchdog reveals officials knew Congress was the target of the deadly January 6 insurrection, yet officers were instructed to refrain from deploying a more aggressive response that could have helped, quote, push back the rioters. Capitol Police Inspector General Michael Bolton found the agency failed to properly prepare for and respond to the pro-Trump mob despite warnings. The report cites a Capitol Police intelligence assessment issued several days before the attack that warned, quote, stop the steal's propensity to attract white supremacists, militia members, and others who actively promote violence may lead to a significantly dangerous situation for law enforcement and the general public alike. The assessment also warned Congress itself is the target on the 6th. Well, Bolton is set to testify Thursday before the House Administration Committee. Meanwhile, The Washington Post reports domestic terrorism incidents surged to a record high in 2020, fueled by white supremacist, anti-Muslim, anti-government extremists on the far right. The Post found since 2015, right-wing extremists have been involved in 267 plots or attacks, leading to 91 deaths. For more, we turn to a new film called American Insurrection that explores how far-right groups were emboldened and encouraged by former President Trump and what the fears and concerns are going forward. The documentary by Frontline premiered Tuesday on PBS in collaboration with ProPublica and the University of California, Berkeley's investigative reporting program. In a minute, we'll be joined by the film's director, Rick Rowley, and correspondent A.C. Thompson. This is the trailer.
I think about a revolution against the government. We're past the point of peace.
From Charlottesville to the assault on the Capitol.
One of the darkest days in the history of our nation.
We're seeing this country fall apart before our eyes.
How the former president galvanized an army.
Who's our president?
Trump's our president!
You've got a guy who's a nationalist in the most powerful seat in the world. We can actually win. We can actually get our views represented.
Proud boys, stand back and stand by.
The Trump encouraging calls to lock Whitmer out.
Lock them all up.
The far-right militias have felt much more licensed to publicly engage.
Terror plot to kidnap Governor Gretchen Whitmer.
And so you think the guys were planning to arrest her?
It was going
to
be a citizen's arrest.
Two militia groups were preparing to kidnap and possibly kill me.
You don't fight like hell, you're not going to have a country anymore.
Violent mob, stoked by the words of President Trump, stormed the building.
They were hostile. They were venomous that their country somehow was being taken away from them.
In the aftermath of the 2020 election, how these groups have become part of the American political landscape.
What was the role of the Boog Boys on that day?
There was some Boogaloo Boys in the crowd associated with us. They weren't there for Trump. They were there just to mess with the federal government one more time.
Over the last several years, Frontline and ProPublica have been reporting on the rise of hate
about what you did in Charlottesville last year
and their violence.
What do you think was going on in this house?
They were making bombs.
Now, correspondent A.C. Thompson investigates the surge of far-right political violence.
What do soldiers and Marines bring to the Boogaloo?
They bring training expertise in certain areas.
They have decided this is a strategic initiative for them. There's a real, legitimate fear. We've got to be vigilant about it.
I'm afraid that more innocent civilians are going to be targeted and actually victimized by these violent offenders. Everything that we had predicted has come to fruition, and it's actually worse.
The first in a series of films on the rise of extremism around the world.
We definitely are the modern militia.
That's the trailer for American Insurrection, the new Frontline documentary now streaming on PBS.org. For more, we're joined by A.C. Thompson, PBS Frontline correspondent and staff reporter with ProPublica, who's covered the rise of right-wing extremist and white supremacist groups for years, and director Rick Rowley, the Oscar-nominated, Emmy-winning filmmaker, independent journalist with Midnight Productions. We welcome you both back to Democracy Now! A.C., you begin this documentary on January 7th, the day after the deadly insurrection in Washington, and then you make your way back to the University of Virginia. Talk about what we're facing now and the buildup.
You know, the concern that I have at this point is that we may see an act of mass casualty terrorism sometime in the relatively near future, because we have a massive pool of radicalized individuals who have been fed a abundance of lies by the former president, by this entire conspiratorial right-wing media and social media ecosystem. And that is the concern I have For us, the film traces sort of what happens from Charlottesville with the white power movement, which was emboldened and catalyzed by former President Trump, up to now, where we see the sort of white supremacists fading and these groups we saw on January 6th coming out, the street fighters like the Proud Boys, the militias, the Boogaloo Boys. And that's sort of the arc that we're tracing here. We expect trouble from those groups in the future.
And AC, in the film, you explore several of these groups. And the Proud Boys, for instance, the Cuban-American Enrique Tarrio, who is the one of the leaders of the group, several of these folks are not, they're white supremacists, but they're not white themselves. And those of us who know the Latin American history know there's always been an extreme right-wing trend among people of Latin American descent. Could you talk about the Tarrio and the Proud Boys and what you found?
Yeah, that's a great question. Honestly, a few years ago, our colleague Kareem Hajj and I were filming in Portland and filming these Proud Boys rallies. And we thought, you know, how do we even make sense of these guys? Like, you know, because they're ethnically mixed, they're sort of white supremacist adjacent, like they're hanging out with white supremacists, but that's not how they categorize themselves. And I think the term that we came up with was sort of multicultural fascism, multi-ethnic fascism. You know, in the film, we meet a member of the Proud Boys, and he's wearing a shirt that says Pinochet did nothing wrong, referring to the fascist Chilean dictator. And that's a thing that we saw over and over again with the Proud Boys, is shirts that said right-wing death squads, shirts that talked about throwing socialists and leftists out of helicopters, as happened in Chile and Latin America during the dirty wars. So that's the sort of thing that I think these movements, the ultra-nationalist movements, really represent, is a multi-ethnic fascism.
I want to go to a clip from your documentary, American Insurrection. You report on Stephen Carrillo, the active duty Air Force sergeant accused of shooting dead a federal security officer in Oakland during last year's protests over the police killing of George Floyd. Remember, it was originally blamed on Antifa, but then it turns out to be that Carrillo killed not only him, but a deputy sergeant in the Santa Cruz County Sheriff's Office. He belonged to the anti-government Boogaloo Boys movement and was interviewed by investigative journalist Gisela Perez de Acha from jail.
Before he was captured, Carrillo wrote messages in his own blood, including a single word that would be the key to all the chaos. Boog.
And what the Boogaloo is a revolutionary thought.
Carrillo told Perez de Acha that he was part of a movement called the Boogaloo Boys.
The Boogaloo movement, it's about people that love freedom, liberty, and they're unhappy with the level of control that the government takes over our lives. Being free to do what you want as long as you don't hurt anyone else.
Aren't you accused of hurting someone?
Oh, that's what I'm accused of. But, so back to the example, that's what I wanted to get to. You know, it's the freedom of choice, the freedom of expression.
Carrillo has pleaded not guilty, and he wouldn't answer questions about the shootings.
Did you find it hard to get him to actually...
It was so hard. It was so hard. He would just deny and skirt every question.
How did you come to this? How did you... Because you said you didn't read a lot before.
Basically, through friends. Friends, you know, the Air Force. Once I joined the Air Force, you know, I traveled around the world. I met people from all over the world. And just talking to people changed my whole views.
So do you think that he's saying that he found these radical ideas in the military?
Yeah, I think mainly from my conversations with him, I think it was definitely radicalized at the Air Force.
So we were hearing the voice of Carrillo there from jail, thanks to the investigative journalist Gisela Perez de Acha. And you're talking to her, A.C. Thompson. Now, central to this is the military's prominent role in the white supremacist movement. I mean, you even interview a Pentagon spokesperson who says this is what they're looking at now, the disproportionate representation of police and military in the white supremacist movement. Tell us more through the story of Carrillo.
Yeah, so Stephen Carrillo is a 32, now 33-year-old Air Force staff sergeant. He was assigned to a sort of elite security unit called the Phoenix Ravens within the U.S. Air Force. He'd been in the service for many years. And the truth about Stephen Carrillo, who is facing the federal death penalty for allegedly killing a federal security officer, facing state charges for murder for allegedly killing a deputy down in Santa Cruz County, California, is that he was representative of a much, much broader nexus between the military and extremist movements, most prominently anti-government militias and the white supremacist movement. Now, Stephen's Mexican-American. He wouldn't identify as white supremacist in any way, but he does identify with these sort of extremist, extreme libertarian ideas and this really anti-government sentiment that we've seen swirling around many people in the armed forces in recent years. We did reporting that found that basically found some 20 members of the Boogaloo movement with military ties, many of them active duty. 13 of them had been jailed on serious, serious criminal charges in the last year. Our colleagues at Berkeley found another 15 active duty airmen, many of them connected to Carrillo online, who were promoting Boogaloo anti-government content while collecting a government paycheck.
And Rick Rowley, I'd like to bring you into the conversation as well. Could you talk about this? First of all, the timeline of the film, starting from Charlottesville through a variety of other events that most Americans don't associate as part of any kind of continuum, but also the role of social media as you got into this story in the growth of these groups.
Yeah, thanks, Juan. I mean, I think really the important, a major important takeaway for everyone is that, you know, we look too often at these movements as a monolith, as an unchanging kind of thing. But actually, the far-right ecosystem is diverse, and it evolves, and it takes advantage of political crises as they appear. And if you don't understand how it's growing and changing, then it becomes impossible to understand the kind of threat they pose. So, We begin in Charlottesville, with Unite the Right, the explosion of the largest white supremacist, openly white supremacist demonstration in our lifetimes. And there was a backlash after that. That was actually quite effective in splintering and breaking up the overt, explicitly white supremacist organizations that were there. The main groups behind that, you know, they dissolved or they changed their names or they just kind of disappeared. But what happened was, something else happened there, and that was that Trump, with his response to Charlottesville, he made explicit something that had been imminent inside his campaign for a long time, and many elements inside the white supremacist movement found in him a path into the mainstream, and so they took off their swastikas and they wrapped themselves in the flag and they joined groups like the Proud Boys. At the time, the Proud Boys seemed to me to be kind of a joke, right? Not a very serious player in this space. But they became a vehicle through which neo-Nazis and white supremacists could enter into a mainstream kind of organization. And, you know, one of the great interviews that AC does is with this guy, Brian James, his career is like a bingo card of far right violence, like the Klan, militias, you know, where he met Tim McVeigh. He founder of a neo-Nazi skinhead gang that's, you know, whose members have been committed, who have been convicted of multiple murders. Now he's a Proud Boy. And he says to us on camera that, you know, that he sees that now they can win with someone like Trump in power, in office, and then also just offering them this vehicle into the mainstream. And so, you know, what you mentioned earlier, Juan, about Enrique Tarrio and the Black and Latino members of the Proud Boys, this is a very self-conscious move by the movement to put forward an image of themselves that is difficult for people who haven't watched them evolve to classify. So people look at them and it's hard to call them white supremacists because they can't, you know, it's hard for them to square that image because they haven't seen them evolve. I mean, the slogan, Pinochet did nothing wrong, Hitler did nothing wrong, was a slogan, you know, started, I think, on Stormfront a couple decades ago and sort of popularized. They just take the Hitler out, put the Pinochet in, and suddenly they're a multi-ethnic, multicultural fascist movement that it finds a way to become more acceptable.
I want to go to another clip of American Insurrection. This is about the Boogaloo Boys.
I need to see the movement for myself. I go to Virginia, where a Boogaloo cell is marching against a local gun ordinance. 50 protesters show up. They have body armor, assault rifles, and outlawed high-capacity magazines. They carry igloo flags and wear Hawaiian shirts and ironic patches. The group is led by Mike Dunn.
How are you feeling about today?
Liberty shall not be infringed.
Has this been a success in your mind?
Liberty shall not be infringed.
Dunn postures like a seasoned squad leader. But this doesn't look like a group that's going to lead a violent insurrection. I can see the threat they pose, though. Boogaloo Boys have demonstrated the potential to carry out acts of violence. Some in law enforcement and the intelligence community also saw this threat, but I've been told that their concerns were rejected by the White House.
Among the counterterrorism community, we took it very seriously, but you really do need that presidential level leadership saying this is a threat. We are going to use all of our tools to go after this threat. That never happened under Trump.
Elizabeth Newman was one of the top counterterrorism officials in the Trump administration. She says she tried to warn the White House about the rising threat of far-right extremists, but the president and his allies claim the real threat was from Black Lives Matter and Antifa.
Does Antifa exist? It's not an organization, it's a movement. You have groups of people that associate with them. Do they show up at protests? Sure. Is it a massive conspiracy to overthrow the U.S. government and kill a lot of people? No. You know where that is? It's on the right. It's in the white supremacist movement. It's in the anti-government militia movement. It's in the Boogaloo Boy movement.
So that is key. That was Elizabeth Newman, who was a Trump administration official who quit then because the White House kept stressing it was the threat was Black Lives Matter and Antifa, when all of the facts indicate the overwhelming level of violence. The number one domestic terror threat in this country are the white supremacists, are the anti-government groups, this right wing that coalesced on January 6th. You have Mike Dunn in there. You, AC, you say he's gone underground now. What do you see as the next insurrection or threat? And what about how the Biden administration is dealing with this?
You know, I think the fear that I have, and I've gotten this from our interviews with people like Mike Dunn, is both federal agencies and federal law enforcement being targeted. They are a particular target for people in these militia and militant anti-government groups. As well, I think there's a real concern with state-level and county-level officials being targeted, particularly in states that maybe have more serious COVID restrictions. I think that's the thing we saw in Michigan with the kidnapping plot there against the governor, particularly in states where they may be moving to enact some forms of slightly more aggressive gun control laws. Those are the concerns I think that we should all have, and that's what's been articulated to us. Is like, look, it's not just that we're targeting the federal government. We're targeting everybody.
AC Thompson, we want to thank you for being with us. PBS frontline correspondent, ProPublica reporter, and Rick Rowley, Oscar-nominated, Emmy-winning filmmaker, just released American Insurrection, a new frontline documentary now streaming at PBS.org. That does it for our show. We have a job opening of a senior video producer, senior news producer to join our team here in New York City. Learn more and apply at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe. Wear a mask.